books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today we'll explore the life of Roger Butler in the book The Light of Day by Christopher Stevens and Louise Radnowski. There's a welcome return from Dave Steele, the blind poet, along with filmmaker and director Matt Hopkins on the film I'll Never See. Plus some book recommendations from Carnegie shortlisted author Matt Goodfellow, author of The Final Year.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
The Light of Day.
The first man to come out at the dawn of gay liberation is a book by both Christopher Stevens and Louise Radnowski, assembled from the papers of the late Roger Butler, who lost his sight in his 30s. Sir, we are homosexuals. So began the letter penned by Roger Butler and sent to several British newspaper editors, some of whom were so shocked they thought it was a hoax in June 1960. Writing such a letter 7 years before the decriminalisation of homosexuality was a radical and dangerous move. It was a risk that set a major milestone in the fight for gay rights, one that has been almost entirely forgotten. This is the story of the first man to come out voluntarily, using his own name, to the entire British public, a decade before activists started petitioning gay people everywhere to come out proud. Taking us through a criminalised underworld of gay pubs, parties and activist meetings, The Light of Day charts how Roger helped bring about the legalisation of homosexuality, but soon found himself marginalised from the movement he kick-started after losing his sight in his early 30s. Enter Christopher, a student asked to visit and read to an old blind man at the beginning of a new century. As their intergenerational friendship bloomed, Roger came to trust Christopher with his most precious possession, memoirs of his revolutionary past locked away in his home. After Roger's death, Christopher opened a series of unsent letters left in a pink folder addressed to him. They contained Roger's final wish, for Christopher finally to bring his remarkable hidden story into the light of day. The audio version is narrated by Christopher Stevens and Griff Mellowish.
The pink folder. I knew where it would be. It sat, no, was sitting. Roger hated that slip and regularly corrected me. In the top drawer of the secretaire bookcase that dominated the drawing room at 41 Regent Street. A pink folder waiting for me. The glass upper portion of that bookcase, with its OG curves, those lines of beauty that Roger had explained when we read the Allan Hollinghurst novel together, framed a small, heavy bust of Napoleon, who seemed in that moment to be holding guard over its contents. I stared off Napoleon, opened the drawer, and there it was. Reused, typical Roger, and a little frayed, the pink folder sat atop a neat pile of documents. Stuck to its front were two white labels, one in Braille, one typed.
In the event of my death, this folder is to be given to Christopher Stevens.
Roger had let slip during a bedtime conversation the previous August that he had been writing a one-sided letter correspondence addressed to me. This was a kind of diary, he explained, a record of the final years of his life. But he hadn't intended for me to know about it. Roger had wanted me to discover the letters at some future point, after his death. Until then, they would remain hidden in that folder, in that drawer, and further discussion would be off limits. I, of course, had wondered about those forbidden letters ever since. I had been at Roger's bedside, in the hospice, as he drew his last breath on a cold January day in 2011. Hours later, when I let myself into the house that he had loved, standing in his hallway, I was consumed by a terrible mix of grief and relief. The ending of a life had also been the ending of weeks of watching my old friend die. In that heady mix of emotion, I was drawn to those letters. Perhaps they offered the promise of some stability and a more attractive prospect than the grim round of telephone calls that lay ahead. Perhaps I had cried enough and wanted to hear Roger's voice again in some way. Perhaps it was no more profound than the desire to satisfy my curiosity. So, sitting, yes, sitting, on Roger's deep red sofa, facing the small bay window onto Regent Street, I opened the pink folder.
The voice of Christopher Stevens reading from The Light of Day, and both authors slash editors of the book, Christopher Stevens and Louise Radnofsky, join me now.
The Light of Day is a story about my friend Roger Butler. Roger, who I met in 2003, at first in order to be a reader to him. He was blind and living in East Oxford when I was a student, and was someone that I got to become very friendly with and learnt an awful lot about his life during our time of reading together, particularly when we read some of his own writings, his reminiscences, his memoirs.
All being well, there's one thing I want you to do for me posthumously. I want you to take charge of all my letters and scribblings. I'm afraid I've accumulated rather a lot over the years. I've left instructions that all this stuff is to be handed over to you. The scribblings, particularly, I want you to have, all those random pieces in binders, for reasons you can understand. I may pass them over to you myself nearer the time if I get the chance. Many of them, though by no means all, you're already familiar with. You, from whom no secrets are hid, or not many. What you do with any of this stuff will be entirely up to you. It will be immaterial to me by then. Oh, my love, sweet boy.
Up to me, perhaps, but I knew Roger well enough to hear this as an instruction. And through that process, I got to learn an awful lot about his time in London in the 1950s and the 1960s. He'd been part of the gay rights movement back then. However, it wasn't until after Roger's death when he left me a series of letters asking me effectively to tell his story, to take all of his writings, his diaries, his letters, that I discovered that in fact Roger had had a far more significant role in the gay rights movement than I had imagined. And then in fact, Roger had been the very first person in the country to come out as gay voluntarily to the entire British public in order to change the law.
How did Roger actually lose his sight?
Roger was diagnosed at the age of 2 with glaucoma. He describes in some of his writing, which we've included in the book, this very distressing process as a very young child of having an operation at the age of 2, being strapped down to a bed when he woke up. That surgery was designed to help Roger to continue to use his eyes. But from that point, he was heavily reliant on very thick spectacles and was then for, a couple of decades. And it's not actually until 1960 that things really have a step change for Roger in terms of his sight. He's been struggling all of that time. He's very limited in terms of his vision, but he can still get by with the use of his spectacles. But from 1960 onwards, things start to go very wrong for him. And then in 1965, after an operation which was designed to try to help relieve the pressure in his left eye, he lost the vision completely in that one. And then the same thing happened again in 1966 to his right eye, at which point he could no longer see anything.
Now, as I said in the introduction, we're also joined by Louise Radnofsky. Louise, how did you get involved in this story?
Well, I've known Christopher for more than 20 years. We were university students together, and Christopher helped me and my partner have a child in 2018. And around about the same time, we talked in some more depth about the papers that he had inherited from Roger at that point 7 years earlier, and had been wondering what to do, because there were quite a lot of them, and it was a quite daunting task. And he asked for my help there in seeing whether there's anything that might want to see the light of day, effectively. I'm a journalist. I work for the Wall Street Journal. and we started on this project together.
The papers are obviously more extensive than the book. Was there things that broke your heart to cut out of the story?
Yes, huge amounts. Roger, I mean, for many, many decades, Roger's way of passing time almost was to write. He absolutely loved reading and writing. And what that resulted in were thousands and thousands of papers. And there's so much in that material. There's so much about Roger's thoughts and feelings, his experiences, some of the amazing people that he met that we've only been able to allude to slightly in the book, because how could we possibly include decades and decades of writing and reflection just in one story, and in one story which is just about Roger himself as the center point. But yes, we've wrangled time and time again over particular parts, thinking what could we possibly cut, what must we absolutely include. And one of the reasons that Louise has been involved in this project is to help me to think about what of Roger's story is something which is going to be interesting, something which might be informative and perhaps even helpful to a wider audience. You know, I had a very complex and close relationship with Roger, and of course, I loved him dearly and wanted to tell people about almost every aspect of who he was. But when you're writing for an audience, of course, you need to think about, okay, what is best for people to hear? What do people really need to know about Roger Butler? What's the legacy that we're trying to communicate? So it's been a difficult process, but I think we've reached a very happy point with that on publication.
Roger had an extraordinary process for creating these volumes of material painstakingly. He went to considerable efforts. That's almost an understatement of how hard he had to work in order to create papers that he himself was unable to read without assistance. He wanted to leave this archive of his life for someone to be able to read, to see him. And the effort alone that he expended to create it made me very conscious whenever I was reading it that he had gone to such lengths to create it. We needed to pay very close attention to what he was trying to say and why he had wanted this to be known. That said, of course, as Christopher just explained, we certainly couldn't record the vast majority of that in this book, but there was more than enough that really did need to be told in a single story.
30th of May, 2008. Sweetheart, for the time being, I've run out of subjects I want to write about for the occasional pieces you've so indulgently endured and recorded for me. Nor do I have anyone to correspond with regularly these days, a la Lionel or Cobb. But as I have this compulsion always to be writing something in my unoccupied moments, I've hit on the idea of writing a kind of open letter, or rather an ongoing letter, to you. Footnote. Broadcaster and writer Lionel Fielden, 1896 to 1974, historian and memoirist Richard Cobb, 1917 to 1996. Roger sustained lengthy correspondences with both. I'm not proposing to send it to you. You can read it when I've passed on, as the local kids always refer to the grim termination, or the distinguished thing, as Henry James called it. I'm beginning just after we've returned from our Nottingham weekend, which I enjoyed so much, in truth, more than I expected, not least, in fact, chiefly for being with you.
Louise, did you find yourself writing in part a love story?
It's a really interesting question. We haven't quite been asked that before. I think there are a lot of different love stories in a single book here. There is the relationship between Christopher and Roger. There's also a love story between Roger and books, or anybody in books. It's a book that changes Roger's life in the first part of his life story. He reads Peter Wildblood's Against the Law in Leicester Square and suddenly has this realization from it. He sees himself in this other person who's identified himself as a homosexual in the 1950s. And then you have Roger's own love of reading, which goes throughout his entire life, and in his later years in particular, brings him into contact with all of these people who are his readers, one of whom is Christopher, and the friendships that are almost built up out of that reader relationship. And then his own desire, his own ambition to be a published author, which has been realized by Christopher on his behalf after his death, that's also an act of love.
And we can't ignore the fact, Christopher, that this was a very dangerous act. He came out as a homosexual using his own name when that was still a criminal act.
Yes, absolutely. It was such a brave thing to do. And I still try to think about Roger as such a young man. I met him when he was in his 60s. And so thinking about this 20-something who was doing this amazing thing that no one had ever done before, it's quite incredible. You know, people in the 1950s, 1960s were being arrested, not even for being caught doing gay things, but just for the conspiracy, what was called a conspiracy to commit these crimes. So just the idea that you were perhaps going to at some point was enough. And we include in the book a series of really painful letters that I picked up from newspapers like The Spectator, The New Statesman, from the 1950s and the 1960s, telling stories about gay men across the country who were being terrorized by police investigations. You know, couples who had been living together for decades in quiet rural parts of England, who were suddenly under suspicion, who end up, you know, in some cases, tragically killing themselves because they know what's going to happen. They know about the not just the possibility of being sent to prison, but the social ostracism that was involved in being identified publicly as a homosexual at this time. So even if Roger wasn't arrested actually for doing anything, the fact that he said something so publicly and so willingly is an incredible act and something which we knew the world needed to hear more about.
Do you think Roger's message of hope is still relevant today?
I think Roger has two very important messages. One is the political significance of a person standing up and identifying themselves voluntarily, unashamedly, as being a member of a group that is reviled. We see in 1960 the power that has to transform both the conversation around decriminalization of male homosexuality and the movement, in fact, that is operating, which is largely in 1960 still led by well-meaning straight people operating on behalf of homosexuals, often not talking about them in ways that are particularly complimentary and more of sort of pitying things. So that's one very crucial campaign tactic established. There's also a second very powerful moment that Roger himself recorded. He's in hospital recovering from the second surgery that has left him completely blind. And he meets a 19-year-old, Diane, who had lost her sight in a car crash. And she convinces him not only that a great many more things were still possible than I might have supposed, but also that they still mattered. And this is a message that for Roger had tremendous resonance at the time as he rebuilt his life, decided what he really wanted to do with it, and decided to go for that thing, even though it was more difficult for him to do it than it had ever been before. But in a strange sort of way, he was freed up to pursue this ambition of going to university, reading for a history degree, doing that in Oxford, and his life pursues for that. But in addition, I think this is a message that a lot of people who have a life-altering event and are trying to reconstruct from it might find helpful. I've certainly quoted this line to a few people. Not only that a great many more things were still possible than I might have supposed, but also that they still mattered.
There was one of the things that I found fascinating, actually, when I was researching a little bit around what Roger experienced at Torquay and at Leamington Spa. There's two training centres that he went to. It was a film, it's a 1955 film, which I got from the archives of the National Film Institute. It is about a person doing almost exactly the same thing as Roger, going off to Manor House to go and be trained to be able to find employment after losing his sight. So you actually see some of the rooms that Roger experienced and that he talks about, and some of the stuff that we include in the book is in there, which was a brilliant experience to hear someone else's perspective. It's very much written as a documentary, so it's slightly austere, I suppose, and done for an audience, certainly. But seeing some of that stuff and hearing someone else's experience of what it's like to go through the same thing from about the same period, probably 10 years earlier, really, really fascinating.
It was one of those moments of revelation, one of those road to Damascus things. In the pale sunshine of the spring of 1957, Roger Brian Butler was sitting on a bench in Leicester Square, devouring the book he had just discovered, which was about to change his life. He had found it in a display of new paperbacks, set out in piles on a table in front of a parade of bookshops on London's Charing Cross Road. One of the Penguin publications, with the familiar white and orange cover, had caught his attention. Its title, in elegant, bold, black typography, was Against the Law. But it was the author's name, Peter Wildblood, that caused him to look more closely. Roger's life in London had, so far, been sedate, unremarkable. He enjoyed the freedom of a young man in a large city without commitments or expectation, and found some fulfillment in his job at a high-end estate agency. But a typical Saturday afternoon browsing bookshops was as much an event as anything else he had done or seen to write home about. In this moment, the elusive something interesting that Roger had come to the city to find, though perhaps not to write home about, had presented itself.
Now, Christopher, you'll know this more than anyone, having read books to Roger, but the book The Light of Day is now available as an audiobook. Is that important that it's accessible to anyone for whatever reason, be it sight loss, dyslexia, doesn't have a relationship with print?
It was incredibly important to us that the audiobook was going to be produced and not just made as an adjunct to the print version, but actually that it would stand on its own as something which people who either needed to access the text through audio or who wanted to would appreciate and think was special in some way. I knew how much Roger had loved his talking books. He was a big, big fan of the RNIB talking books scheme. And it was something that we spoke to very early on with our editor about trying to work out a way that we could ensure the audiobook was special somehow. So one of the things that we've done in order to try to make that the case is to include some bonus material at the end. Louise spoke earlier about the processes that Roger used in order to create his written material. And one of those involved using a dictaphone to make notes that he then wrote on a typewriter from. Another was that he sat down with a reader, and much of the time in the latter part of his life, that was me, with his materials and a tape recorder in the background, recording those materials being read, but also the conversation that we were having about those materials as we went. And so we have three bonus tracks at the end of the audiobook, which are taken from those recordings. So they're slightly scratchy because they're very much a sort of home tech from the early 2000s recordings. But one is Roger talking about his parents and his relationship with his parents. Another is a recording of me and Roger reading together from one of his letter correspondences. And the other is Roger drafting a section of a letter that he wrote to me from a selection that he was writing towards the end of his life of letters to me which he never sent, but which he left for me to find after his death.
This is a section to insert following the description of Ma's death. My parents are not easy to describe, comma, partly because of filial inhibitions, and partly because they were a couple who might almost be said to have specialized in being ordinary. Dad, at any rate, comma, they kept themselves very much to themselves and rarely revealed whatever deep feelings they had. But particularly in the way of anxieties or disappointments.
And you recorded your own parts of the audio version. How was that?
It was a completely new experience for me. It was just one very intensive day sitting in a very sunny studio. By the end of the day, I loved it. It was challenging to listen to my own voice as I spoke, which I hadn't realized is part of that process. But it was really meaningful, actually. And I hope that what it brings to the audiobook too is a sense of immediacy with the material. There's an awful lot in those sections which I read, which are in my own voice, which relates to the nature of the relationship between me and Roger, particularly towards the end, thinking about what Roger meant to me, what I've meant to him, and my experience of being with him at the end of his life. And I would have been nervous about anybody else reading that. I didn't want voices or anything that would make it feel like it was anything other than genuine, authentic, because that's exactly what it is. And so I'm very pleased with the results. It did mean a lot to me, and I hope that readers appreciate it and that it does have that sense of immediacy with them.
And Louise, Griff Mellowish reads the rest of the book. How was it listening back?
I mean, he did a fantastic job, and again brought the professionalism to this experience that we thought was entirely appropriate. But in addition to that, there's sort of a question about the bonus material. Obviously, with the print book, there is a special section of photos included in the middle of it, and that's a sort of bonus that you get with the book. And as Christopher said, it was important to us to offer bonus material to anyone who wanted the audiobook as well. And so the bonus track sort of served that purpose. But I would like to believe that audiobooks will continue to contain the sorts of extras that you do get from a book and expect to get from a book, and that becomes the expectation going forward for audiobooks.
Prompted by no precise impulse except an unaccountable curiosity, Roger recalled, he bought the book for 3 shillings and 6 pence and took it across to one of the seats in the square. He tore through most of it in the next 2 hours until the strain on his eyes from reading caused him to stop. Against the Law proved to be nothing short of a revelation about himself.
The Light of Day, the first man to come out at the dawn of gay liberation by Christopher Stevens and Louise Vrednovsky, is out now in print as an ebook, and an accessible version is available in audio, both commercially and from RNIB. And Christopher and Louise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I did ask Christopher and Louise one last question, inspired by the books of my life, part of Read On. Did Roger have a comfort book that on a rainy day he could curl up with and reread?
I think one of the writers, certainly, who Roger enjoyed reading, perhaps more because of his relationship to them than necessarily the material itself, was Lettice Cooper. Lettice isn't hugely well known these days, but she actually had quite a significant success in the middle part of the 20th century. One of her best known books was Fenny, which was about a woman who goes off to Florence. It's a little bit like A Room with a View, I suppose, that has that sort of feeling to it. Lettice Cooper had been an enormously important part of Roger's life. She'd been there for some of the most significant moments and had been at his bedside, one of the first people to be at his bedside after he lost his sight completely. And Lettice was the person to whom Roger was writing when he sat down to first start drafting his memoirs about losing his sight. It had been her idea, her suggestion that he write about it. And so I know that Roger very much loved to go back sometimes to Lettice's own writings to remember that woman who he felt a little bit like was a fairy godmother to him in terms of some of the ways that she had helped him through life. And I'm sure that he would want to mention her.
Helen Fenwick first came to the Villa Meridiana in April. Long before the train ran into the station at Florence, she had been sitting on the edge of the seat, a starter poised for a race, handbag, overcoat and umbrella disposed on one arm, so as to leave the other free for her luggage. She recognised that she had not the same grip on the wagon the attendant as the companion who had shared her sleeper as far as Pisa. This woman, the wife of a hotel keeper in Lucha, with a daughter married in England, had chatted to her in bad English ever since they found themselves in the same compartment at Calais. But she was a hardened traveller, who with one wave of her hand and its tight black glove subdued the unknown terrors of the journey and left Ellen free for enjoyment, replying, "Yes? Really? Do you? That must be nice for your daughter." She sucked into her eyes the mountains of northern Italy, the pink farms, and the interrupted glimpses of the sea appearing between the rattling tunnels. Now it was dark and she was alone. To watch the Signora, who had been her family in space for 24 hours, stump away under the platform lights of Pisa between her husband and son who had come to meet her, was for Ellen the final parting from home.
Fenny by Lettice Cooper is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Nina Holloway. Other Lettice Cooper books in the library are Snow and Roses and The New House.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
I think every person who lives with sight loss has that thing said to them all the time.
A white cane sweeping the ground.
You don't look blind. Well, you know, what does blindness look like?
Dave, a bald white man with a beard, is walking to a football field with his son, Austin. Our lives.
So, I've got one for us.
Streaming on BBC iPlayer now as part of the Our Lives series is the film I'll Never See, a documentary from director and filmmaker Matt Hopkins about the blind poet Dave Steele and his family and the journey they all go on as Dave's retinitis pigmentosa progresses to the point of the loss of his remaining useful vision. Matt followed Dave for 3 years, and both Matt Hopkins and Dave Steele join me now.
My name's Dave Steele, I'm known as the blind poet, and I, for the last 10-11 years now, have been using poetry as a way to explain the realities of living with sight loss, and a lot of people use my poetry as a way for them to explain to other people how they feel.
So the film I'll Never See is 3 years in the life of Dave Steele, the blind poet.
Director and filmmaker Matt Hopkins.
It basically documents his journey from having limited vision to no useful vision at all. I think when you explain that to people, it can sound like a very sad story that people might not want to engage in, but it's kind of anything but that. It's more of a story of a family coming together against the adversity they face.
When you have low vision, you have a little bit of sight that actually doesn't work properly. That's really hard for people to kind of get their heads around and understand. So close. Keep it there. You ready?
Come on, Dad.
Is this hitting?
Is it?
Nope.
Austin hits the goal's crossbar with the ball.
So I have retinitis pigmentosa, and I've been losing my sight progressively for quite some time now. Right, where'd it go?
Dad, so turn around.
Uh-huh.
And then it's just a bit to the right.
Even being able to see kind of what I can see today, that little bit, is at the last stage as well. So every day to me is seeing things potentially for the last time.
It was about 3 years ago when I first heard Dave's story, and I got straight in the car, drove up to Manchester, and just started talking to Dave without a camera at first, and started hearing about his story. And we started filming kind of quite soon after that, but we realised it's a film that's going to be told over a long period of time. Dave can probably speak best to this, but you don't just lose your sight overnight. So it was a film where we had to be really patient. And it was a film where small changes over time create big kind of story beats. And the fact that I live the other end of the country today, but I live in Brighton. So I basically come up every so often with a camera, and I'd obviously notice these changes in Dave's vision probably a lot more profoundly if I was like in his life on a day-to-day basis.
The whole premise came from that idea of what's it like to lose the last part of your sight. I think a lot of people, when they're diagnosed with any kind of sight loss, spend far too much time worrying about what it's going to be like if they get to the stage where they can't see the family's faces anymore. So I wanted to show a real honest account of actually what that's like and how as humans we all adapt and how it affects not just the person, but the whole family.
Were they involved from the start?
Yeah, 100%. It was a decision we kind of all made together. You know, obviously they're well aware of the work that I do, you know, in my kind of realm as a blind poet. And my wife now works within the sight loss community as a children and young persons enablement officer for a charity. They were kind of all in that this story needed to be told, that families as well as, you know, people going through this need that kind of mainstream representation, and actually how we don't have a real honest account of what sight loss is like in mainstream. Quite often when they show blindness, they show it in a very kind of dumbed down way to sell a story very quickly. It's very much playing to the stereotypes and reinforces that you don't look blind aspect that a lot of people get asked. So we wanted to, you know, show a real honest account and show something that's really rare on TV these days, and that's definitely the feedback that we've been getting from people that have watched it so far. That is life. It's ups and downs, it's good days and bad days, and we wanted to be really honest with that. And actually, you know, as much as there are those moments that are really raw in it emotion wise there's some really great kind of humor in it as well, and the way we deal with things as a family. And that was one of the great things about Matt and the production company and all the crew that worked on it, is they really managed to capture us as we are as a family. There was no acting, you know, there's no setting up of scenes. It was us as life was playing out. And that, you know, that is a really rare thing to see.
Matt, what has the making of the film taught you about accessibility?
That's a really interesting question. So I came to the film with little to no knowledge of sight loss. I think the access point for me was David posted an Instagram story and saying, I'm losing the last of my sight. And that obviously triggered, I just never almost probably engaged with sight loss before this. So I was really starting from kind of no knowledge. And I think the first time I came up, I just, you know, would go for a walk with Dave and we'd walk around with Christopher, his guide dog, and have a cane. And I was like, so is Christopher with you the whole time? I was asking all those stupid questions, I guess. And over time, I think the big thing I've learned is that accessibility should be part of every facet of life. You know, it's not just about getting somewhere on a bus and, you know, you being able to access that. It comes to the digital world as well with the way you interact. It kind of just pops up in the kind of areas you really wouldn't expect. And I think this is what I think was almost so important about me as somebody without knowledge or not huge knowledge of sight loss about making the film. I think I wanted to make sure people without sight loss could understand it. And this, going back to your previous question, this was like a big reason for the involvement of a family. We can all relate to families. I'm a father as well. So I think it's important to try and engage with our audience on those themes that are universal. And that's the access point for trying to understand what sight loss is really like.
Talking about accessibility and understanding, what sort of research did you do in order to recreate the illusion of sight loss on the screen? You know, you're recreating what Dave could see at the time.
I think that was all. It was all from conversations with Dave. Like, Dave, you'd shown me quite a few times these apps you have, which can recreate that feeling of RP. So you open your phone and there's an app there, and the image will suddenly, you know, it'll have this black vignette around it. But I'd spent time with Dave in so many different scenarios that I thought, okay, I had an idea of what it would be. But obviously, I think the intention to do that on camera and do it in the room and really understand, and so Dave can tell us this is what it's like, that was really important, because I'll never know, you know, I'll never truly know what that's like. So I really wanted Dave to lead on that aspect of it, especially.
The thing is, as well, one of the things that's really difficult is, and I was explaining this to Matt, and I remember when I explained this to Matt, it kind of blew his mind a little bit, was when you get that representation of, say, something like RP on a screen where they show that tunnel, it's very well done within the film. But one of the things that's really hard to kind of put across is they always show like a tunnel, but then obviously the rest of the screen's black. Now, for someone with that sight loss like myself, you haven't got like black in your vision and then this tunnel. The blackness isn't there. And just explaining that to people is really hard for them to get their heads around, that, you know, you haven't got this kind of black area in your sight. It's just not there.
Yeah, that blew everyone's mind.
There are plenty of shots of Dave around the table or at football matches, but there are also lots of shots, Matt, of Dave on his own from a distance. Was that to highlight the sort of isolation?
I mean, definitely. I think there's a real duality I came to learn about Dave's life, where it could either be all go, and this isn't just this is part of Dave's life, I think, anyway. Speaking for you, Dave, like, you know, you're a very busy person, and it can be 100 miles an hour, or it can be Dave alone for long periods of time, kind of stuck in this world.
With regards to kind of the challenges and battles of isolation, that's one thing that so many people affected by, not just vision loss, but disability, experience all around the world. And actually, it doesn't matter whether you have a great network of a family support around you or not. You know, we all go through these moments where, due to the limitations of our disabilities, we struggle with isolation. And, you know, I have a really busy life, but at times that busyness could just be me in a room all day, stuck at home for days on end with the curtains shut, just working on my phone. And that balance, getting out there, is something that, you know, needs to be shown to the world for them to understand better.
At the time of recording, it's been on iPlayer for just over a week. What sort of feedback have you had so far?
The feedback has been incredible, you know, from people saying it's the most realistic, authentic, honest accounts of sight loss that they've ever seen on mainstream TV. I've had so many messages from people, you know, families, people within the sight loss community, people outside of the sight loss community. I had a lady reach out to me, a young family from down near, actually just outside where Matt lives, just outside of Brighton, who have a 3-year-old son who was just diagnosed with RP in April. And they watched it and said that it was the first time since their young son's diagnosis that they've actually felt as if they've seen a representation that they can understand and something that they can relate to. They felt seen. So that in itself is really, really powerful. But yeah, there's so much more. And that's another one of the reasons why we want to get as many people as we can to experience it.
I mean, I'll just kind of echo what Dave said, really. I mean, I've had personal feedback. Oh, the film's great. You get feedback on the filmmaking, which is all great. But I think as a filmmaker, I'm just so invested in making the film, right? I want to make this as good as it can be. And you get to the end of that process, and then you suddenly start thinking about, okay, this is going out in the world. Okay, great. And I just wasn't really expecting to hear the feedback that we have from people who have similar conditions. And that's just meant the world to us. It's the feedback where people have said, this has given me hope. It's made it all worth it.
And Matt, where can people see the film I'll Never See?
It's currently screening on BBC iPlayer.
Yeah, so just search Our Lives series on the BBC iPlayer, and then if you go into the episodes, you'll see one of the episodes there is the film I'll Never See, which is us.
And Dave, if someone wants to hear more about your poetry, how can they get in touch?
Go to my website, theblindpoet.net, or just look up The Blind Poet on Facebook and you'll find me. But yeah, always around. I wanted to show what it's really like to lose the last part of your sight. Showing the good, the bad, the full spectrum of how it really is. And seeing not just how I cope with it, but how my family deal with sight loss, blindness.
The film I'll Never See, in white lettering that's opaque and blurred in places.
Our Lives, the film I'll Never See, is available on iPlayer with audio description now.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, continuing the theme of poetry, here's Carnegie shortlisted poet Matt Goodfellow, author of The Final Year, with the books of his life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Well, there was a book that stands out for me. I was a funny one, you know, and people expect me all the time because I'm a writer to be a big reader. I've got ADHD, and so it means that my concentration span is quite short. So I try my best to read, but I have to do it in short bursts, which is why sort of poetry and verse novels are great for me. And also, I didn't really like my dad when I was a kid, and he did a lot of reading, so I sort of purposely didn't read, which, you know, that's the rebel within me. But I read a book when I was a kid by Alan Garner. It's called The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, and we studied it at primary school and went to the theatre to watch it. And it's this book, you know, it's the sort of book that I'm not into at all now, really, as an adult, but it's about wizards and, you know, witches and that sort of stuff. And it was set in a place not far away from where I lived in Manchester. So it really interested me. So, yeah, and Alan Garner actually is I think he's probably our greatest living writer in the English language. So that The Weird Stone of Brisingamen is the one that stands out from my childhood.
At dawn, one still October day in the long ago of the world, across the hill of Alderley, a farmer from Moberly was riding to Macclesfield Fair. The morning was dull but mild. Light mists bedimmed his way. The woods were hushed. The day promised fine. The farmer was in good spirits, and he let his horse, a milk-white mare, set her own pace, for he wanted her to arrive fresh for the market. A rich man would walk back to Moberly that night. So, his mind in the town while he was yet on the hill, the farmer drew near to the place known as Thieves' Hole. And there, the horse stood still, and would answer to neither spur nor rein. The spur and rein she understood, and her master's stern command. But the eyes that held her were stronger than all of these. In the middle of the path, where surely there had been no one, was an old man, tall, with long hair and beard. "You go to sell this mare," he said. "I come here to buy. What is your price?" But the farmer wished to sell only at the market, where he would have the choice of many offers. So he rudely bade the stranger quit the path and let him through, for if he stayed longer, he would be late to the fair. "Then go your way," said the old man. "None will buy, and I shall await you here at sunset." The next moment he was gone, and the farmer could not tell how or where. The day was warm and the tavern cool, and all who saw the mare agreed that she was a splendid animal, the pride of Cheshire, a queen among horses. And everyone said that there was no finer beast in the town that day. But no one offered to buy. A weary, sour-eyed farmer rode up out of Macclesfield as the sky reddened the west. At Thieves' Hole, the mare would not budge. The stranger was there. Thinking any price now better than none, the farmer agreed to sell. "How much will you give?" he said. "Enough. Now come with me."
The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, a tale of Alderney by Alan Garner, is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Steve Hodson. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, I think I'd gonna have to go for Skellig by David Almond. David Almond, I think he's in the same breath as Alan Garner as a person that writes beautifully about place and about people, and uses the voices of people in the places that he cares about. And Skellig is referenced in the final year. The teacher, Mr. Joshua, reads his year six class Skellig, and Nate begins to realise, well, do you know what, I can do that sort of stuff. And when I became a teacher, I wasn't ever supposed to be a teacher, so I didn't know anything, and I didn't have kids at that point, so I didn't know anything about kids' books. I didn't even know who like Michael Rosen was. And I remember reading Skellig to my second class that I ever taught and going, wow, so writing for young people can be as textured and nuanced and as important, maybe even more important, as writing for adults, and it just blew me away. So it would have to be Skellig, I think.
I found him in the garage on a Sunday afternoon. It was the day after we moved into Faulkner Road. The winter was ending. Mum had said we'd be moving just in time for spring. Nobody else was there. Just me. The others were inside the house with Dr. Death, worrying about the baby. He was lying there in the darkness, behind the tea chests, in the dust and dirt. It was as if he'd been there forever. He was filthy and pale and dried out, and I thought he was dead. I couldn't have been more wrong. I'd soon begin to see the truth about him, and there'd never been another creature like him in the world. We called it the garage because that's what the estate agent, Mr. Stone, called it. It was more like a demolition site, or a rubbish dump, or like one of those ancient warehouses they keep pulling down at the quay. Stone led us down the garden, tugged the door open, and shone his little torch into the gloom. We shoved our heads in at the doorway with him. "You have to see it with your mind's eye," he said. "See it clean, with new doors and the roof repaired. See it as a wonderful two-car garage." He looked at me with a stupid grin on his face. "Or something for you, lad. A hideaway for you and your mates. What about that, eh?" I looked away. I didn't want anything to do with him. All the way round the house, it had been the same. Just see it in your mind's eye. Just imagine what could be done. All the way round, I kept thinking of the old man, Ernie Myers, that had lived here on his own for years. He'd been dead nearly a week before they found him under the table in the kitchen. That's what I saw when Stone told us about seeing with the mind's eye. He even said it when we got to the dining room, and there was an old cracked toilet sitting there in the corner behind a plywood screen. I just wanted him to shut up, but he whispered that towards the end Ernie couldn't manage the stairs. His bed was brought in here, and a toilet was put in, so everything was easy for him. Stone looked at me like he didn't think I should know about such things. I wanted to get out, to get back to our old house again, but Mum and Dad took it all in. They went on like it was going to be some big adventure. They bought the house. They started cleaning it and scrubbing it and painting it. Then the baby came too early, and here we were.
Skellig by David Almond is available from R&IB Talking Books, as read by Jim Norton. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, there's an incredible book by a writer who I've got a lot of respect for. She's called Liz Hyder, and she writes beautiful books. And I read a book that she wrote a few years ago now, I think. It's called Bear Mouth. Sort of a YA audience, but it just blew me away. It's just something completely different, something that I could never write, I think. So yeah, Bear Mouth by Liz Hyder is an incredible read.
I am learning my letters. I am learning my letters. I am learning my lettuce. I am learning my letters. I am learning my letters. Better, says Thomas, as he blows out the light. 'Tis hard work, using my brain. Thomas teaches me at lunch, when the others are at cabin, and sometimes on Maker's Day, I have lessons after prayers. In the week, the men sit and discuss things for grown-ups at cabin, and us youngs aren't allowed in. Men's talk, they say, not for youngs. So I sit out here with Thomas, and he teaches me my letters. They are hard. Only me and Tobe are learning letters. The rest are too old. Tobe is more young than me, but he learns fast and all. Thomas is my best friend, though he's twice my age and more. He looks after me, keeps an eye out. I am different, see? I am not one thing or the other. They call me Eunuch, for I am not a boy, nor yet a woman, and they hold no truck for girls down here, so I must by all accounts be a eunuch. Not one thing or the other. Thomas don't like him calling me that, though, so he calls me Newt. M-E-W-T. Newt. I like that. Thomas says it is an underground creature, small and nimble. Like me. Learning letters is hard. My eyes strain at the end of lesson with the brightness of the candlelight. Then 'tis back to work for all three of us. Bearmouth is my home, see. 'Tis called Bearmouth, 'cause it was near the surface, with its wide open maw, so as could walk straight into the mine. But then they dug down, deeper and deeper, miles and miles down, so we are toasty warm at work. So 'tis the wrong name now. Bearmouths are for shallow mines, and we ain't that. It should be called Black Pit, or Centre of the Earth.
Bearmouth by Liz Hyder is available in audio commercially, as narrated by Kit Griffiths. The Final Year by my guest Matt Goodfellow is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Bradley Thompson. It's also available from RNIB in Braille. Also, both the Final Year and the First Year are available commercially as read by Matt Goodfellow himself. And Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.